Welcome to St Alfred's, ladies, and welcome to our grief and loss seminar this evening. It's lovely to see you here, and I hope you will take something away from tonight that will be useful, as well as enjoy a chat and some supper at the end of our evening. I'm sure when we reflect back on our lives, we can remember experiences to varying degrees of loss. Throughout our lives, we accumulate layer upon layer of experiences of situations where we might have had that sense of loss. And it can be physical, emotional, spiritual. And common to these is a loss of hope and the loss of expectation. Liz is going to put up some of those experiences on the screen. You may have had deep disappointments, unfulfilled expectations. You may have experienced infertility or disability, retrenchment, empty nest, illness, and that's including chronic illness and pain, loneliness, dislocation from familiar things, relationship breakdown, loss of friendships, separation, divorce, increasing frailty that happens in old age, depression, bereavement, and that might have been death of a child or a parent or a spouse. And then there's the whole range of devastation because of natural disasters and man-made disasters. And we only have to turn on the news to look at that. Graham Fulton spoke of the perfect storm of grief. And I really like this photograph because it is, it's the full storm of grief. But on the other hand, I can think of experiences of loss in my life that it might have just been a rain cloud over the top of me. But there's also been times when it has raged like that. So there may have been waves of emotion, the winds of disturbed behaviour, the fog of disturbed thought processes. So grief is individual, it's unpredictable, it's overwhelming, and it's understandable. Just imagine if we couldn't grieve, what that would be like. The Bible gives us many examples of loss and grief. It just reminds me that there is nothing new under the sun. In Psalm 34, verse 18, it says, "The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit." I find that quite comforting. What I was really interested to see was the range of grief and loss actually expressed in the Bible. Right back in Genesis, it says about the grief to Isaac and Rebekah regarding their daughter-in-laws. And I thought, ooh, ouch. Jacob tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and mourned for his son Joseph, presumed dead, for many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son." And so his father wept for him. Hannah was a woman deeply troubled. She was infertile and longed for a child, and she poured out her soul to the Lord. She prayed in the temple out of her great anguish and grief for a child. David knew great loss and sorrow, and we have many psalms in the middle of the Bible that reflect some of his feelings. But Psalm 31, I find, is particularly, just catches me. "Be merciful to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eyes grow weak with sorrow, my soul and my body with grief. My life is consumed by anguish, and my years by groaning. My strength fails because of my affliction, and my bones grow weak. Jesus, too, was not a stranger to grief and loss. And it's very poignant when we read of the death of John the Baptist and how that affected him. He withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. And when his friend Lazarus died, he stood at the tomb and wept. So tonight, we're also going to hear some personal stories from two of our lovely ladies here at St Alfred's who are part of our family here, and they're going to share a particular experience that they've had. And we're also going to hear from Anne Walker, who's a senior counsellor at Carinya. So she's also going to be talking to us about grief and loss. So with that, I think Edwina, if you'd like to come up.
Well, I'm here because almost exactly a year ago I found I had breast cancer, and I proceeded to have a lump removed, then a mastectomy, then chemotherapy, and 3 months after that, which is in March this year, I had breast reconstruction surgery. So it's almost exactly 12 months, so I'm still really sorting it out, but I'm quite happy to share with what's happened. The stats tell us that 1 in 9 women in Australia will have breast cancer, so it's quite a common thing, really, and it's probably quite a good thing to understand. So I'll tell you a little bit about my experiences of the last year. My cancer was found by the grace of God. I felt a lump which seemed new in my breast. I've got lumpy breasts. Had a mammogram and an ultrasound, and the lump that I felt was benign, and a very small half-centimetre black thing was waving at us on the picture. And that was cancer. So after the biopsy, when we realised it was cancer, it took me quite a while to get back to my GP to get the result. You know how you just don't need to call, so you put it off. And when I eventually did call, it was halfway through a meeting because I thought, oh, I've really got to make this call. And I found out that I had the lump was cancer. My goodness. I wrote it down on a scrap of paper in front of me. And I remember over the next few hours, because, of course, I went back to the meeting, the next few hours I kept looking at it thinking, that can't be true. You know, that just can't be right. But it was in print, so it had to be right, didn't it? It just didn't fit the picture of me. It was too, just wasn't real. So when I did have a moment, I can remember withdrawing to the car park to call Doug and bursting into tears. So that's where I'd gone for privacy, and I burst into tears. That was obviously the first time it really hit me. And his immediate response was, I'll come right now. He was fabulous. And he's come right now to everything since then. He's been at all the appointments. He's listened with me and questioned with me and recalled with me what was really said or not really said. Been there for treatment and surgery, sat with me while I looked at prosthetic boobs and decided whether or not I wanted to go that way. He's been available with me, prayed with me, and he's managed his work around it all. So he's great. When you see him, give him a pat on the back. And really, for the experience, we're a lot closer. So I'd have to say that, you know, one thing that we've learned is that not all things that come out of adversity are bad. It seems that from the first surgeon's appointment we had, we enter what we refer to now as cancer land. And for us, for being in cancer land meant that all of a sudden appointments and all sorts of other things were far more important than anything else that we thought up to then was important. Even immovable work deadlines, you know, things that you've been working towards for 2 years, that they just had to just evaporate. And that's pretty, you know, that's a pretty disconcerting thing. It happened all of a sudden. And it was quite disorienting. One of the things that we had to do was get enough information to understand what we were talking about. You know, there were results and things that specialists talk about. So we had to get a bit of technical information. My bedtime reading became Breast Cancer for Dummies. It's a very good book. And although normal life at home needed to go on in the beginning at least, I had this big cloud of horror that I just had to attend to. I had to find out what I needed to find out and just, you know, sort of really deal with it. It was very, very disorienting, really. And as we progressed and I was off work, Cancerland became a place where I was recovering or feeling sick. And my life felt as if I was on a parallel track to everyone else. I remember feeling that being told you have cancer is a bit like being told you're off to the Antarctic tomorrow and you can't pack anything. Because it was unfamiliar and daunting, and it really was quite the adventure. We really didn't know where we were headed. So it also meant finding our way through a maze. Each piece of information took time to be interpreted by the specialists and laid out and considered. And the next step was not always clear. Sometimes there were complete U-turns. There'd be a decision made that something needs to happen and then a complete change that, no, it won't. So we had to learn to put up with that. That was confusing, and at times it was quite annoying and frustrating. You know, you feel like giving them a piece of your mind, which, you know, little pieces of mine came out. I can remember finding that we had no idea where we were going, and then reflecting that, in fact, I never really know where I'm going. I just think I do, you know, which... We think we know what's going to happen in the next little while, but really we don't. Really, we don't have a hold on that, and that was, you know, that became very real. So, for some of the first stages, the information went a bit like this. The first lump was very small. Well, that's good, and I could picture a tiny little thing that just got snipped out, and that'd all be really sorted out. Then the lump pathology suggested that it had friends, that it might not be the only one there, and I thought, oh, that's not so good. But then the cancer showed it appears not to have spread beyond the breast. Well, that's great. I can keep my lymph nodes. And then it does look like you'll need a mastectomy. It does seem like there's more cancer in there. We'll just have to take the whole breast. And I thought, oh, my gosh. I had mental pictures of mutilation, really. It was quite confronting. And after the mastectomy, the pathology showed that there were a lot more cancers in my breast that hadn't showed up on any imagery, and that was spooky. I thought, oh, I don't like the thought of that at all. And then, yes, chemotherapy is recommended, and I thought, oh, that sounds revolting. So, you know, as we went, we wove our way through there. We didn't know when we started out that that's where we were headed at all. So we learned to try to not have expectations, and I learned not to try and get too far ahead of myself and to inform myself too much, which I could be prone to doing. So I just got enough information and held it at that. Perhaps the toughest part of the whole expedition to the Antarctic was enduring the chemotherapy, I think. Firstly, I'm someone that actually really enjoys eating a really healthy diet, and, you know, I've avoided toxins, and not obsessively, but... So it's a bit of a challenge to rock up for chemotherapy, put your arm out and say, yeah, you know, just slip it in as much as I want, as much as I need. And also knowing, it's a real psychological struggle, knowing that the drugs are going to make me ill in a few days, and that, you know, as the pattern went on, I knew where it was going, and that was, you know, it's pretty hard to turn up and have that happen. It took quite a bit of steeling of my mind. And in fact, I found it harder than surgery, which is, you know, quick and all over, and then you just have to recover. But I felt very blessed. I only had to have four doses. So lots of people that have many more than that. Through chemo, I went back to work when I felt I could. And a lot of people advised me to stay away from work. Don't go to work. You'll just get tired and you'll get all worried. But in fact, for me, being back at work was part of getting better. I really enjoyed it. I wasn't sick when I was at work. I was just getting on with what I do at work. I was around work colleagues, and it was a really good thing, good place for me to be and part of my healing. Support from friends near and far was an absolute lifeline. And we sent group emails to inform people what was happening, and that was really to protect us from a tsunami of phone calls which certainly did come in the beginning. And the emails brought really unexpected reconnections with people overseas and long-lost friends, and it was quite amazing. And those really kept me going, especially through the grey days of chemotherapy. And my work was very supportive. They almost begged me to give us meals. And I felt such an imposition until they told me, listen, they just want to help you, just take the meals. And I went, oh, okay, right. I got the picture now. I thought I was really being, you know... thought I was being a problem, but people just loved doing that, even though it was complicated. I've got all these complicated food intolerances, and they managed really well. So I didn't often feel great or beautiful or happy, but I did always feel loved. And friends dropped in food, flowers, cards, and brought company. And at times I felt so thankful for these things, I didn't really know how to respond. I felt quite inadequate. I had many conversations with God. But I wasn't always able to. I wasn't always able to talk to him. And much of my prayer was at survival level to get me through the next day. It was quite, you know, just Lord, just help us to do this, get this bit and get that bit done, and look after this and look after that. And I was extremely grateful knowing that other people were praying. And it was very helpful for me when other people prayed with me at church and in our home group. It was a really sustaining thing. And for me, that reminded me that God was in action. You know, God hasn't left the scene because people are praying for me and caring for us. Body changes are a huge part of breast cancer. So I lost a breast, but at no point was I actually breastless. Because in one operation I had my breast removed and a temporary breast-shaped tissue expander put in under the pectoral muscle. So I remember asking the surgeon, will I wake up with a breast? And she said, yes, you will. And I did. So I actually never really lost that breast in a way. It was a big part, a significant factor of me feeling whole, that I was, and I feel very fortunate that I was able to have that kind of treatment. So I have a new breast. The second surgery that I had in March placed a silicon implant where the temporary expander was. And to be honest, I liked my old breast better. I liked the original one. You know, I have mixed feelings about it. The breast is numb, so that can feel quite strange, having a numb breast when your hand comes across or your arm goes across the breast and there's no feeling. You think, oh, yeah, that's right. And it bugs me a bit that the breast implant doesn't match my own breast, but, you know, that's what happens. I'm absolutely marvel at the art of nipple reconstruction. I can give you a whole one-hour lecture about that at another time because I'm sure you're all fascinated. And I am really thankful to have access to surgery like that because, you know, I work in developing countries where people can't even get the most basic of medical care. And to think that I could have this, I feel quite, you know, really very thankful. And really I've come out of it pretty well, I think, breast-wise. I lost my hair, as many of you will have noticed, and I'm now regaining it. And I found something very important, which is that people are very interested in hair. It was difficult finding the right sort of gear for my head to coordinate with my clothes and that the kids thought was okay and that, you know, I felt comfortable in. And I got lots of questions. I really wanted to say, I just hate all this hair talk. It's just hair. I don't care what it comes back like. I just want it back. And I bought a wig, but I could never wear the wig. I felt like I was pretending I had hair, so the wig's going to go on eBay at some point. So I lost weight, and I'm in the throes of menopause because chemo's brought on menopause. So I've got hot flushes, a flagging libido, and on bad days I can forget an entire conversation that I've had. So to be honest, that doesn't feel like loss. It's just another part of adjustment. I mean, I'm nearly 50. I'm about that far off 50, so, you know, figure. I'm in the region. So at times I have lost self-confidence. I've had some really low days where I felt as if I'm just a skinny, bald version of my former self with a plastic boob. And, you know, I get a bit wobbly and I second-guess all my judgments, you know, and I had friends staying with me and I think I said something like, does this look all right? And they went, does that look all right? You'd never ask that. So I knew that I was sort of, you know, not as confident as I normally might be. And Doug says I lost happiness for a while. But I found a psychologist to talk to and reflect on things, and that's been really helpful. That's been a really great part of moving on. Lastly, the thing that I've lost that perhaps has the greatest impact is what I'd call innocence. And it's perhaps the biggest thing that's come out of my cancer chronicle so far, I'd say. But it's not all loss. Before the diagnosis, I could live as if I was going to live to old age. You know, I was healthy and I thought I was. Longevity on both sides of the family, so I'm just cruising along. But that's how it was. And while I consider the cancer gone and I've got strong prospects of good outcomes long term, I do feel as if I've had a peek at the horizon, which is the end of life, and it looks closer. And it means I live life a little bit differently. I value being here in a way I previously didn't. I'm grateful for God's gift of eternal life in a new way, and I keenly appreciate now that I've got a place to go. You know, I knew that before, but I don't think it really kind of grabbed me in quite such a way. And I'm planning special family holidays and think of ways to celebrate life and enrich the time I do have with Doug and our kids because now I really know I've got it. And while I remain committed to work, I know it's not what really matters. I value time with friends and neighbours in quite a different way. Perhaps it's best summed up as this. Before cancer, I was the mum who said, no, kids, you do not need a treat every time we go to the shops. That's just ridiculous. But now I'm the mum that says, let's get a nice morning tea while we're out at the shops. And I'm always a soft touch for an ice cream, so thanks. That's all from me.
And Joy is a mother and a grandmother of six. She's also the pastoral carer of our MOPS group here at St Alfred's, so that's Mothers of Preschoolers. And she was married to Ian for 33 years. And sadly, Ian died about 7.5 years ago. So Joy is going to share with us something of her experience of grief at that time. Thanks.
Well, Bev asked me to speak about what it's like to lose a partner. And it was good because after Ian died, I actually kept a journal for 2 years. Every single day I wrote in the journal. In fact, I enjoyed it because all the blab I normally talk to him, I put down in paper so then I can go back and have a look. And I was thinking about my grief experience, and I came up with the idea of icebergs in the mist. Now, it's sort of like icebergs in the fog, but I thought the mist made it sound like a bit more romantic. But thinking of perhaps the mist being more like a fog, a lot of people said to me at the beginning, well, you know, Ian was sick for a couple of years. You knew this was coming. You must have been ready for it. You know, there must have been some fog warning sign. But no, it's interesting that we were all ready and we had prepared for Ian's funeral. He'd written it. He'd asked people to participate in it. And so in our head, we knew what was going to happen, but our heart and our head weren't together. And after Ian died, I got up in the morning and someone came to the door and said, how are you? And I said, I'm okay. Then I went inside and I just wanted to vomit. I was just, the shock just hit me and all day. So I ended up having to get a bottle of brandy, but, and that did calm me down. Well, okay. Now, the iceberg's in the mist bit. Now, first of all, you've got the iceberg. And one of the things I became aware of, that there was a whole lot of grief that I had to deal with, but I couldn't deal with it. And that I only could deal with a tiny little bit that was poking up the top. So the icebergs were there, and I could only deal with what I could deal with. Now, the thing, and then they were pushed up. So as I dealt with the top bit, they kept getting pushed up. Now, all the hardest bits were down the bottom of the iceberg. So I was only dealing with the easy bits at the top, and each time I dealt with an easy bit, the iceberg would move up. Now, the mist thing was very interesting because you go into this sort of, people have called it a veil, a mist, a fog. I did a story about it being like bubble wrap because you become veiled from the world and reality. And this is pretty neat, isn't it, really? Because you couldn't cope otherwise. First of all, you only have to do with the easy stuff at the top of the iceberg. And secondly, you are in a mist for a whole year. The other thing about the mist that isn't good is that you're hazy, you know, so you don't... You can't make decisions, you can't do things, the world, you're not engaging with the world, so it's got its good and bad points to it. The grieving process. One of the things people told me is that there is no normal and everyone is different. But in the early days, grief looked like this for me. I would cry about 6 times a day, normally just a few minutes. And that grief was normally triggered by a good event, something I remembered that was really lovely and I knew it would never happen again. And so I would cry. Now, I'd been reading some of Ian's books. He had a whole lot of grief books and I pulled them all down, got to read. I read this one, was the Tasks of Grief, and it was saying that the tears were good. So every time I cried, did my 6 cries a day and gave myself a tick. Thought that was good. Always thought that this was, tried to encourage myself. In those first few weeks, the other thing that happened is that I dreamt that I was dying and I was in hospital, I was dying and I couldn't find the buzzer and no one came. And it was interesting because I think it was my subconscious saying that I had to die. A whole part of me had to die. The part that had been in ministry with Ian had to die. My relationship and the way we related had to die. There was lots of death for me too. I recorded in my journal that for the first 3 months there was not 1 minute where Ian was not out of my mind. He just totally engulfed my thinking. But at the end of the 3rd month I had half an hour. Half an hour had gone by and I hadn't thought of him for half an hour. I thought it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. But that was the beginning of me going into something a bit newer. Now, around months 4 and 5, I went into the book said, and I did my diagnosis, that it was complicated grief because I cried all the time. But this happened because when 3 months before Ian died, my mother had died. It had been an accident. She'd fallen in the night. She'd stayed on the floor for a few days and died of pneumonia. And that was while Ian was dying. Now, the amazing thing with grief is I was able to take all the grief of my mother, even go ahead with a wedding that weekend, and put it in a zip and zip it up. Isn't that amazing? And let's put it aside and just didn't look at it. But in the months that came, the house had to be sold. I was there with the real estate. The stuff had to be thinged and I had my complicated grief and I needed some help. That was my diagnosis and I got some. Now, the other thing that about grief is your children's grief. You really feel for your kids. And I thought, look, they're just not grieving enough. They're just not crying enough. I mean, this isn't right. But someone said, apparently the kids hold back and they wait to see their parent go into grief before they do. It was a really hard thing for the kids because Ian was a real orbit in the family. He really held things together. And normally that's the mother, but in our family, it was Ian. One of the children said to me, you know, why did Dad have to die? Why couldn't you die? It was a bit mean, wasn't it? But I did understand what she was saying. Another child said, why couldn't have Dad died at 40 when he had bowel cancer? Then I wouldn't have known him so much. And then the grief wouldn't be so bad now. So there were just comments that were made. The interesting thing about the kids is that about the 6th month they came to me and said, I dreamt that Dad died tonight. And in that 6 month I died too. So the whole 4 of us in the 6 month I dreamt that he had died. So we'd sort of made the same journey, I think, of the subconscious accepting it, but in different ways. The other thing about the children is you end up being a burden to them. Not only have they lost a parent, they have to parent their parent. And that's really, really hard for them. And, you know, just 3 months before, my mother, you know, she had 5 years. My husband, my father had died 5 years. And every time I went to my mother, she had this list. Have you got one of these old mothers? And she had the list. And this is what she wanted to do. And I used to think, oh, I just can't bear going up there and I'll have to get the list. Within 3 months, I had the list. Every time the kids came, I had the list of what had to be done. Later on, I would learn how to do these things like pay bills and stuff. But in the beginning, I was the lady with the list now. Okay, that's what I've got, coping with the new normal. Now, the first year, I talked about the mist and the protection. In the 2nd year, for me, that mist disappeared. And I had to face the reality of Ian's death with no protection. And that was really, really hard. And I've talked to quite a lot of widows, and they normally say the 2nd year is the worst. And that's because the mist is gone. Not only that, is the tougher edge of the icebergs are being pushed up all the time for you to cope with. So year 3 is a better year. But there are no straight ways out. For me, there've been lots of setbacks. I think when I'm sick, I think that's one of the hardest times to manage on my own. I thought in the beginning, how will I ever get over this? I mean, I'm not going to. how can I cope with the death of my best friend, my lover, the father of my children, even my priest and counsellor? It seemed impossible to be able to get through it. And one of the things that surprised me is the resilience of the human heart, and that God has created us in a way that we can get through. The grief process enables us to get through. We may fall back, but the grief process moves us on. And I didn't know what was happening, but I just held on. I was thinking about Edwina and how she was saying how things change. And I wanted... I suppose when your partner dies, you really know death. You know, you really know about death, and you want to make the best of your life. And one of the things that I did, I remember I had foot surgery, and they said, "What are you going to do after the foot surgery?" And I said, "I'm going to dance." And I went off and I did 2 years of rock and roll dancing. I went out and bought a boogie board and a wetsuit, and I did boogie boarding and wetsuiting myself through life. Now my hip is gone and I'm not so, but afterwards I think I'll get back to the dancing, the boogie board. I haven't given it up. So I wanted to make the best of the life that I had because I knew how precious life is. Okay.
Thank you so much, Joy. That when I think about that, I just cannot imagine what that would be like to actually, come alongside the death of your husband, you know, your lover, your best friend. Graham and I are always arguing as to who's going to go first because of that very reason. Neither of us can contemplate what it would be like to be without the other. It was interesting too. Not that long ago, a group of the older women here at St Alfred's, now when I'm talking older women, the 80 and up, met together for lunch. And my mother was telling me about the discussion that they had. And they were actually talking about the experience of losing their husbands. They're all women. And they were actually reliving a lot of the emotions of what they'd felt at that time and how they were now. And my mother said it was so fresh. And I realised you don't ever really lose that, do you? It's not, you don't ever completely move on new, free, because you always carry some of those memories and that love for that person in your heart, whether it's husband, child, good friend, whoever. So thank you, Joy. Thank you very much for sharing that. Anne Walker is the senior counsellor at Carinya Counselling, which is just down the road, down Springfield Road and round the corner. She's a psychotherapist and she's worked with Carinya for about 11 years. And she also has a private practice and works full-time in counselling. She has an absolute genuine passion for her work, and with her main areas of expertise being grief, relationships, depression and anxiety disorders. Carinya, for those of you who don't know, actually has a staff of 11 counsellors consisting of psychologists, child play therapists, psychotherapists, disability counsellors and general counsellors. In her spare time, because I don't know how you have any spare time, Anne, but she is married and she has two adult children. Her daughter has just recently returned from overseas and her son's leaving to go overseas at the end of the week. So I'm sure you're experiencing lots of emotions at this time. She enjoys her spare time very much with her family and friends, but she still finds time to cook and to go out for coffee, and that sounds pretty good to me. And we look forward to what you're going to share with us now, and we appreciate your knowledge and your vast experience with working with people who have experienced grief and loss. So thank you so much for being with us this evening. Thanks, Anne.
We should have done it in height order. Tallest to shortest.
Yeah, I think that's...
Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for inviting me along tonight. And it's been lovely hearing your story, Edwina, and also Joy. And I think grief is extensive, consuming, and very varying. It's varying for each person. So it was really nice to hear your journeys, and I hope they're going to be a good one for you. You continue good health, Edwina. Okay. How's that? Can everybody hear? Good. So if we've got I've got a PowerPoint presentation which Liz is going to take charge of. I might just look on my phone. I might be playing up with the audio. Thanks, Liz. So grief and loss. Well, it's going to be... I'm just going to touch on a few things. We could talk for a long time about many different areas, but I guess I just want to glide across and give you a bit of a snapshot. I think Bev alluded to... Bev just alluded to how grief is a human response, and it's very much around the way God created our bodies, I believe, to deal with a situation of change. And we've heard Joy talk about the loss of her husband. Well, there are many, many grief experiences that we have. Can you just pop that up, Liz, so that it just comes in? Thank you. And perhaps keep going. Thanks. That's it. And the emphasis is being on moving through the grief process so that we don't get stuck at any point. I think there are different ways of managing moving through the grief process, and one of the most important ways is to show emotion, which will be crying. Crying, I think, is probably the most valuable. I loved hearing you count that you cried 6 times a day, Joy, and that you went to the car park to cry. I think often people want to cry alone, so it's not something that you do in a group. You often withdraw into a private time and have crying then. You'll cry with friends as well sometimes, but most commonly people, you know, one of the things that happens constantly in counselling, when clients arrive, they sit down and we start talking and then the tears come and they always apologise. And, you know, I think that's so sad that people say, oh, I'm sorry, because crying is a very, very natural way to express our grief. And I often say to people, if you're avoiding that, please don't. Find a time when you can sit or shower. Shower's a good place to cry. Because it's a bit like a pot. I often say to, especially when it's female clients, imagine the pot's boiling and the lid's on and there's all this steam and bubble happening in the pot. And, you know, the lid, you're trying to keep the lid on. It won't stay on. It will bounce and steam will shoot out and there'll be some spitting. And if you lift that lid and allow that steam to come out and the pressure, then everything will settle in the pot. And I think emotion is very much like that in our bodies. I think God created our bodies to express the emotion, the sadness, and crying does that for our bodies. So, you know, it's a very important part of allowing yourself to do that. Now, where am I? Okay, so can we go on, Liz? Thank you. Okay, and of course the way we grieve depends on the circumstances. We've heard two different issues of loss. There can be, people can hit grief very dramatically if they've lost a job. and they'll lose their identity in that loss of job. So there are many, many ways. A client just recently came in and she just didn't know what was happening in her life. We sat and spoke for a while, and it came up that she'd lived in the same house, in the same area, all her life. I think she was about 55 and had moved way out and was really grieving the familiarity of the street that she lived in most of her life and the suburb that she'd lived in all of her life. And, you know, going down to the shop, she said, I was always waving to people. I'd be in the car park and I'd see someone and chat. I'd back out the drive and then I'd be talking or waving. So she was very much immersed in grief. And actually, because she'd not realised it and it had been ongoing for a while, she had then found that she was dealing with depression as well. So that can be something that actually flows through if a person doesn't really sit and know their grief and allow themselves to identify it and then for it to be part of, you know, going through it in their life. Okay, so yes, and age and gender. Well, of course, gender, men don't talk very much, do they, usually? So they will often be very internal with their loss and less communicative, whereas I think women lean more to chatting, coffees and sharing verbally. So gender is very much a part of the experience as well. And our belief system is very impacting. I think Edwina alluded to her thoughts around eternity. Eternal life became precious, I think you said, Edwina. So I think, you know, we can be blessed as Christians to have that faith, but there are people who don't, and I think they can travel probably fairly more severely through the grief and loss process because they've not got the hope that we hold as Christians. Thanks, Liz. Okay, and I'm not sure who said grief wasn't predictable before. Maybe it was Bev that was alluding to the lack of predictability around it. But we don't know how we're going to react often. When you're in that situation, you might be aware of some of your behaviours, but we can't really predict how we're going to be when we're immersed into severe grief. And I think it can be a bit of a surreal experience. But once you've gone through it, I guess you realise, Edwina, for you, what some of your characteristics were. And Joy would have as well, you know, that you realise whether you withdraw, people often do withdraw, or some people want to just be with friends all the time, so they'll want to be surrounded. And it's just good to know if we can look in and think, well, what do I do? You know, when something happens and I feel, you know, the initial shock and disbelief, how do I respond? What are my characteristics? And it just helps us know our patterns of grief and then make space for them. It's important. Okay. So the reactions that we have. Grief is made up... I've just realised I've got this over here too, haven't I? Same returning. The bodily sensations. There are also the emotions that we've been talking about, thoughts that we have, and the behaviours. And they're the four categories that we find we're dealing with in the grief process. Okay, so the bodily sensations is just purely how our body's reacting to the grief process, and that's going to be the initial disbelief and shock is people can often just start, you'll see people that are in shock and they'll be shaking and as if they're absolutely freezing. They may be numb. So the fight, flight, freeze responses can come in and, you know, people may just be in that frozen state where they're just look as if, you know, they're not there. Nauseous now. Joy, yes. You said you felt like vomiting. So that's just the body muscular, you know, the muscles just all shutting down. So that's another very common response, and that tummy, you know, horrible sensation. Exhaustion, people are exhausted in grief because their bodies are working so very hard. The adrenaline that our body requires going through the grief process is extensive. And so our bodies are created to furiously cover the adrenaline. It's a little bit like when we're running, we need the adrenaline to be pumping through our bodies to get us to the other end, to where we're running. And grief is quite similar. Although we're not actually doing a run, our bodies inside are working at an incredible rate because we've got so much happening physiologically to us. So for our bodies to cope with that, it's working hard on the adrenaline. So it's keeping the adrenaline up to deal with the grief, and that actually exhausts our body. So it's this, oh, all the time. People often say, I'm tired and I haven't done anything. I get up, I'm tired. I know my sister-in-law had some fairly significant grief probably a few years ago, and actually it was probably 5 now. And she just kept saying, I'm just so tired all the time and I'm not even doing anything. And that's a very typical comment that people will say. So that's very normal. So that's the exhaustions associated with the adrenaline and the stress that the body's working under. Interrupted sleep patterns, that maybe I can't get to sleep, or people get to sleep because they're tired. They sleep for a couple of hours, bang, they're awake, and then the mind starts ticking over. So sleep patterns are often quite irregular. Eating habits, again, they're polarised. You can have the person who stops eating, the body shuts down, it doesn't want food, and then the person that starts to eat for comfort. So we often have very polarised responses in grief. And headaches, the elevated adrenaline I've spoken about, and the temporary memory loss. So memory loss, you know, people will be confused, but know that it's only temporary. I actually think I read somewhere quite a while ago that the brain can be reduced to a capacity function of a 15-year-old when you're in grief. So it's quite dramatically impacted. Okay, so the emotions we're probably more familiar with, the immediate response of disbelief and shock comes with crying and sobbing. So people will often... can we pop roll the next ones up, please, Liz? Thank you. Crying and sobbing, so that's a very off normal response. Again, though, people may be just shocked and numb. So we've got polarised reactions happening again. And they're just naming a few. Guilt, relief, depending on the circumstances. Of course, that's going to be if somebody has been unwell for a long time. There's a sense that the suffering stopped. Okay, and behaviour. The thoughts can be quite scattered and they're going to be quite impacted during grief. So they can become very repetitive, disbelief, so you're going over and over and over again, just reminding yourself of what's happened and the reality of what you're living with. is something that, you'll find that people can be doing. Again, the thoughts and feeling responses will change based on personality. The personality of somebody who is a feeling person will go to their feelings primarily. And some people are thinkers. So you've got feelers or thinkers. And the thinking person is going to do all the thinking and probably less of the feeling. So there's always a primary response between those two. And people will probably do mainly one or the other. Okay, and our behaviours. So the behaviours, again, will vary depending on the type of person that you are. The numbness might come in. That will be an immobilised, stunned, shocked response, and that person may sit quite still, not want to communicate, not want to talk too much. Some people just jump up and want to be go, go, go doing stuff. So I've got to do things, I've got to get out, I've got to get stuff. So they'll be on the go, want to keep busy. And then some of the behaviours are wanting to hold something close that reminds them, if someone's died, of the loss. So I've had all sorts of weird and unusual things that I've heard over the years. But, you know, I think that's probably just having a closeness to someone. It might be the smell or something very personal that they just want to hold and feel good about for a while. And that will pass in time. And the other thing, sorry, I just wanted to touch on, don't worry about going back, Liz, is withdrawing. You know, the withdrawal, people very rarely want to become social in grief. So during the intense time where their loss is very, pardon me, raw, they will want to withdraw. So it's pulling away from being the social person that they may have been previously and just wanting to be quiet and still. And I often use the analogy of the caterpillar that crawls into the cocoon, and the cocoon looks very still. To look at a cocoon, there's nothing happening. There's that, you know, stick sort of looking shaped thing, and you can go up really close and nothing's happening. But in the cocoon, there's a lot of changes going on. Caterpillar's gone in, the butterfly comes out. And I think grief is very similar. I often say to clients, sit, wrap, and just cocoon yourself for a while, because your body is going through grief and it will change. And it's a very comforting thing to do, to just wrap. Even if you feel sad, just give yourself a little bit of time sitting down with the wrap, something that's comfortable. It can be anything, big sloppy cardigan, a quilt, whatever's comfortable, just to wrap yourself and do some cocooning for a period. And just know it's not a waste. It's not, people aren't wasting time. Their bodies are actually moving through a process. So I love the cocooning. Okay, so one of the other, this is a model that I often use in counselling with clients, and it's the Seasons of Grief, which was developed by Mary McKillop. And I think it can be really symbolic of helping people through, to talk about and help people through grief. And we actually whiteboard the seasons. So I'll just talk a little bit more about that. Autumn is when, you know, we have the big, beautiful, full tree laden with leaves and green and thriving. And then autumn is when the leaves start falling off. So we see the change of colour, and then the loss of the leaf on the tree. And the tree will end up very bare and barren. So the leaves are symbolic of the losses associated with grief and change in people's lives. So, you know, irrespective of what the loss is, it's symbolic of the leaf. So we name all those losses to sit and work with a client and say, okay, well, what's happened in this period of grief? What are the changes and the losses that have occurred? And you can end up with a whiteboard full of leaves, really, symbolic of all the changes and losses. And I think it's often then that people see how huge something will be, and something that they've probably thought, but it's only a house move, or it's only, you know, you actually see the impact of your on your life of what something may have. Okay, and winter. So winter really is symbolic of the tree that's standing there, bare, barren, and often quite cold. So to look at the stormy, cold weather, it's not calling us out for barbecues, is it? It's not saying, let's pop out and go for a walk. Winter's very much a time when we want to retreat, do the cocooning, so do the wraps, and stay warm. Yeah, and just have rain coming down and lightning. So it's very much around the feelings associated with winter for the seasons of grief. So, you know, that's your emotions that we've talked about previously, the crying, the withdrawal. What else are some of the emotions you have? They're so vast, so many, and I often just write them up. Okay, tell me some of the feelings that you've had. Isolation, it might be, you know, quite wide and varied. And spring. So spring's when it takes us through to the new beginnings. And that might be, well, I met some new people, or I've started a new group, or I've learned to cook. Men might say that, well, I've got to learn to cook, or, you know, that they can be quite tiny, so it doesn't have to be something huge, and it very rarely is anything huge, because grief doesn't really entice people to make huge changes and moves in their life, because they've usually already had enough, so they're very loath to do too many drastic changes themselves. And summer's when the cycle's completed and life returns to what is then, for them, normal, or as normal as it's going to be. So summer's the holiday month where the sun shines, we like to go out more, and it's a happier month. So I find the seasons something that's very symbolic for people, and they really enjoy and understand it. It's not complicated to talk about. So that's a good thing to do. So there's the leaves that we're looking at now, and then winter's the cold month where the cocooning happens and you stay indoors. Love the tree, that because it's very symbolic often of how people feel in the grief process, and the hope of spring, and then summer. So, and the other thing that I think can be quite helpful is talking to people about the time frame. And I think you spoke about the 12-month period, and I think I heard Joy talk about 12 months and 2 years. Grief does range over a two-year period. The first year is the most difficult, so that's where we can use our seasons again, because the first 12 months is all the first anniversaries, the get-togethers, so they're quite extensive and painful. The 12-month period's painful. The first 3 months, people often say, hardly remember it, felt quite numb, was all a bit surreal. So it's a very intense period emotionally. So I always love it when people have got the first 3 months out the way, because then they start to just move a little bit further along. Okay, so how do we help people It's really difficult to do. Even as a counsellor, I find it really hard when I've got somebody close to me that's grieving, because everybody grieves differently, and we have to be very aware of how the person that we want to help is responding and reacting to the grief process. So if we've got somebody that is wanting to talk a lot, then it's about listening. If we've got somebody that actually wants to be on their own, we need to respect that within the context of normality. So, of course, you wouldn't say, OK, well, I'm gone. You know, you want to be on your own. I'll respect that. We actually need to observe how they grieve, and we can't change the way they're grieving when it's actually happening. It's just not possible. So it's being mindful of how they grieve and understanding that, and then trying to work with that. I know someone very close to me. She had lost her husband, and I was talking to her and I said, "Are you okay? How are you doing? Is there anything you need to be done?" "Oh, I'm fine. No, really, it's okay. I was in and out of the hospital so much, you know. I just feel like I've got my life back again. And I'll be okay. You know, I can get up to the shops now and I can do this. And I hung up and I went, "Oh, shivers, that worries me." Because she was really not acknowledging it at all, and I knew she was going to come crashing down. So it's just standing back and being ready for that and walking with them and knowing that they're going to come crashing down and feel it. And I think in this case it happened around the 3 or 4 month mark. And ironically, her close friend of hers lost her husband, and she said to me when she was talking on the phone, "She's so weird." She said she was nothing like me. She just said to me, "Well, you know, you've got to get on with life," and there was no emotion, and she was really weird. And I felt like going, "So are you." So I was quite struck that she had no realisation that she was the same. So that was very funny. Okay, a noise. When people are in grief, their tolerance is quite lowered, and the last thing they want to hear is a whole lot of noise. So if at all you can be mindful of not a lot of noise or activity, especially in the very, very early stages, weeks, that's really quite valuable. So just to be mindful of that. And I've talked about listening more than talking to them. And that might mean just sitting in quiet times as well, because it's in their quiet times that they're doing a lot of thinking. So if somebody's doing lots of reflecting and thinking, they're often not seeking eye contact. They'll be looking away, or they'll be looking down, and that means that they're going over something. And in grief, that's not a bad thing to do. That's quite healing. Okay, and don't ever tell anybody what they should be doing in grief. And I think often, you know, we need to stop ourselves. Even I'm always aware of that, of saying, "Do you think? Should you?" So it's just allowing them to work through it, unless they're doing something very unhealthy. But they're usually not. So it's just not telling someone what they should be doing, and then respecting their choices, even if it's not what you would do or what you deem would be normal. Okay. And lots of sympathy and empathy, which is really important. Because I think that's probably the Christian way of life as well, you know, to walk with somebody and just love them through a situation. And yeah, offer your company in outings, and they will tell you, they will guide you as to what they feel like doing, what they're up to doing, or whether they just want to sit. So always make the offer, "Would you like me to come over? Do you feel like going out?" And then let them be your guide. Okay, and then I spoke earlier about people being stuck in grief, and it does happen sometimes. People might stay in a place for months, and that's probably when you need to say, do you think it would be helpful to see a doctor or a counsellor? And just touch base with them, just to check that you're okay. And the doctor can do a medical assessment and see if they're suffering with depression, because depression can sometimes come out from ongoing grief. And of course a counsellor will always sit and listen, and we can assess whether somebody's travelling normally and healthily through the grief process. And nutritional food is always good. People aren't going to eat copious amounts of food in grief, usually. I know some people like comfort food, but usually their bodies are so consumed with going through the grief process that it doesn't want to be digesting a lot of food at the same time. So healthy soups and cakes, easy to eat. nutritional food is good. So it's keeping their body healthy. Being healthy in grief is very important. So, some gentle walks, if they're up to it, is an advantage. But nutritional food, so if you want to do something for somebody, if you're wanting to help them, soup's always easy for the digestive system to manage when people are grieving. And prayer, if you don't know what to do to help someone, or if you don't know what to do in grief, prayer. I often think, if I don't know what to say to somebody, this is a close friend, because it's different when, you're not working. It's quite different. Prayer's always there. And you can always quietly pray for them, even if they're not Christians. We can pray for them and ask God to guide them and surround them, and us too, in knowing how to respond. Okay, so I hope that's been helpful. One of the handouts that I've popped in is a sheet that talks about experiences of grief. And this is something that I've used for years and years, because I love it. And I think it's very descriptive, and covers most of the responses that people have in grief. And it starts with disbelief and shock. And I will even look at this in 3 month sections, and again we'll relate that to the seasons of grief. So we might look at the first period of disbelief, shock, sobbing, physical symptoms. And you don't move through this like stage at a time. People can sort of oscillate back and forth, but it often is a 3 month period at a time. So again, that's the 12-month cycle, and this is the intense first 3 months that you look at the first quarter of the graph. So I hope that's helpful to people. There's one other handout that we've popped in, which is called Letting Go. And sometimes people hold on to grief because they don't know how else to remember someone. And I'll often hear clients say, but if I stop grieving, then I'm going to forget what it is that I, the person or the thing, usually the person. So I don't want to stop grieving because that means I've forgotten them. Well, that's not true at all. There are many other ways of remembering somebody besides grieving for them. So that's usually a good thing to talk to a professional about, I think, really. So the verse on letting go, I just love. So I thought I'd pop it in for you all tonight. And it's very relevant for, I guess, many different situations of grief. And one being, I think, Bev spoke about, and that's empty nests. So I give this out to lots of people about my age whose children have leaving and left home. So I hope you enjoy them. So are there any questions? Does anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask? great, I'll go.
Run!
Okay, thank you very much, Bev. Thank you very much.